Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
On our chat with Justice Minister Andrew Little this week, I asked him about the petition he received from the Council of Trade Unions as his role as Minister of Workplace Relations for more paid sick leave, terrorism-related sentencing guidelines and laws, now that the Christchurch terrorist has been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. But I began by asking Minister Little, in his role as Minister responsible for GCSB and SIS, about recent cyber attacks targeting institutions from the Stock Exchange to the Mount Ruapehu's parking system. So, my first question for this week is, as your portfolio on cyber on the GCSB and SIS. Now, recently, New Zealand has a couple of institutions that experience cyber attacks. So, is there any idea on where these attacks originated?
No. There's about half a dozen organisations, both commercial and non-commercial, have been hit by these DDoS attacks. NZX one was... There was a particularly large volume of traffic came to their website that caused the website to crash, and that required then the Stock Exchange to stop trading periodically. But we don't know, and the nature of DDoS attacks is that, you know, they come from thousands and thousands of computers, so all you can do is kind of look at the character of the attack. There were some emails sent to some of the victims of the attacks beforehand, and so Worth is going on trying to identify the origins of those emails, but they are very difficult. And really, given that DDoS attacks are a thing in this day and age, it's really making sure that organisations have preventive measures in place that means that their business or activities aren't disrupted.
What's the official advice for those institutions who have experienced such attacks?
Obviously, they've got to talk to their IT professionals and also their ISP, their internet service provider, about what measures can be put in place. There are other parties, you know, commercial providers of protections against things like DDoS attacks as well, that will help. And in fact, that's NZX ended up going to, they've got their own usual provider. They went to another one, Akamai, a big international outfit that provides this sort of security and protection to organisations and their websites. So, you know, you have to get that professional advice to do that. But it is possible to put in place measures to prevent disruption caused by DDoS attacks. The Met Services are one of the organisations attacked. They said that they managed to get by without too much disruption. So, you know, you can defend yourself against these things.
Considering we are now approaching an election cycle, are there any measures in place to protect relevant institutions, like, say, the Electoral Commission or maybe even political party websites?
Yeah, I know that the security agencies engage with political parties and provide them with protective security advice, and the agencies are there to assist if any political party needs it. The Electoral Commission is gets a lot of good advice, and they work with the agencies too in terms of protective security. We know that one of the most important assets the Electoral Commission has is the database of registered voters. There is a lot of security around that, and everybody is deeply alert to making sure that is not, or the election processes are not disrupted as a result.
What happens if one of the attacks demand for a ransom? What's the official advice surrounding that?
Whenever a ransom demand is made, the official advice is not to respond to it, and certainly not to pay any ransom demand. The nature of DDoS attacks is that they do go away once they realise they are not causing the disruption that they try to cause, or they're not getting a financial reward, which is, if they're demanding that, then they go away. I mean, generally, DDoS attacks come from criminal actors as opposed to state actors trying to achieve political objectives. And the criminal actors, they have a business model, which is that they need to get something back from what they're doing very quickly. If they don't, then they move on to the next project.
Moving on to another topic, this time in your portfolio as Workplace Relations Minister. Now, yesterday you have received a petition from the Council of Trade Unions. So what is the petition about?
I think it's recognising that, and we sort of saw it with COVID-19 and the lockdown, you know, some people had access to sick leave, particularly for things like when, you know, you've been tested, you've got symptoms and you've been tested but you don't know whether you're positive and you're required to stay at home, or you've got somebody in your house who is immune compromised, and it's safer for them and everybody else that you don't go to work for a period of time. And some people had sick leave that covered that, others didn't. Some people had a lot of sick leave, other people had very little at all. So I think it is timely, in the light of our experience with COVID-19, to review what the Holidays Act says about sick leave and whether it's enough, and whether it can be used for the right things. And the petition really calls for that, and it's now with Parliament, and look, we'll have a close look at it.
Now Parliament has officially ended its final sitting. The term is over. Is this something that the Labour Party could pledge to if elected in October?
As the campaign sort of gets underway, we'll make our various manifesto commitments that we do. We will have some commitments to make in the workplace relations field, and just when we're ready to announce that, we will. But I think the CTU and the various organisations that presented the petition, they've raised a very good point, and I think we all need to think very seriously about it.
The Christchurch terrorist has been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, and there are now calls, mainly from the Deputy Prime Minister and New Zealand First, for Australia to take back the terrorist where he can serve his life sentence. Are there any plans to do that?
Well, we don't have any law that allows us to do that, and neither actually does Australia. So, look, I think, as I understand it, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has indicated that he is open to discussions about that with our Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, and I expect they will at some point. But I think, you know, Jacinda has been very clear about she would want to engage with the community, particularly the Christchurch Muslim community, who, you know, been victims of this guy's activity, and get their feeling. I think, you know, people got a sense of satisfaction that the sentence last week meant that the guy is now in prison for the rest of his life. He can go away. We don't have to think about him again. You'd want to be sure that if there is any arrangement to transfer him to Australia, is that those same conditions apply, that he will be in prison for the rest of his life. So there would have to be agreement between the two countries. There would have to be law passed in both countries to enable that to happen. And so that would be some way down the track, even if it does happen.
Could this, even though without a new law, could this be conducted as a form of a one-off treaty or something, extradition agreement?
Even so, it would still require law changes because, you know, correct the law is when the court sentences somebody and hands them over to corrections to look after them. Corrections has to follow the order of the court. So the order of the court is that he is detained in New Zealand. So a law change would have to be made to allow that transfer to happen. So, look, and there could be one-off agreement for sure, just covering just this one criminal. But the agreement would have to be followed up by law change as well, and so they would have to go through the respective parliaments of both countries. But most importantly, I think, and you know, Jacinda Ardern is right, is that she wouldn't want to do anything that was going to kind of cut across the wishes or the demands of the Muslim community in Christchurch. They're the ones who were the victims of this guy's, you know, appalling, atrocious activity. And their voices were heard very loudly and strongly last week. It was an amazing thing that the court did in Christchurch last week. It really empowered those people. And so they've got to be respected. If there's any further discussion to be had about what happens with the prisoner, then we want those voices to be a part of that discussion.
Speaking of the Prime Minister, she also designated the terrorist as a quote-unquote terrorist entity. So what exactly this means in more practical terms?
So this is the thing that can happen under the Terrorism Suppression Act, and what it means is that once an outfit or a person is designated a terrorist entity, then it means that anybody else seeking to support or facilitate their activities, they are then committing a criminal act. And so anybody who thinks that trying to, you know, set up a fund or finance this guy or support him in any way or support his ideology, then they would also now be breaking the law. So that's the effect of that designation.
And moving on to the sentence itself, it's lifetime without parole. I believe this is the first time that New Zealand has imposed this sentence on someone?
Yeah, it is. Look, it is. It's on the statute books to do. It's very rare. It's been raised in previous cases, but the judges have always said in order to get life without parole, it would have to be an exceptional and extraordinary case. And reading the judge's sentencing notes in this case, now that's what, you can't think this is anything other than meeting that test. He did consider whether or not he should look at some sort of concession because, you know, the guy pleaded guilty and he didn't misbehave in court and all that sort of thing. But in the end, the judge said what he did was so overwhelmingly evil and bad and wrong. You know, 51 people killed, 40 others injured, hundreds of others traumatized and terrorized. This justified life without parole.
I know this is very unlikely for this to happen, but in case of other countries like, say, the United Kingdom, even though someone was sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, let's say, maybe in 20 years, this sentence could be quashed by the Home Secretary or by an appeal board. What's the procedure for this in New Zealand, even though I know it's highly unlikely for this to happen?
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to appeal it, he has to lodge an appeal within, you know, within 28 days of the sentence. If he doesn't, then his ability to do anything about it further down the track becomes much more difficult. So, for example, if he wanted to challenge the sentence through the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which could do that, the commission has to be satisfied that you've exhausted all your appeal rights. Well, if you don't launch an appeal, then you haven't made any effort to, then they're unlikely to consider it. No, we don't have a situation where a minister has the power to intervene in a court order. So it would be, he's pretty much out of luck if he's relying on something further down the track to reduce or the sentence or to get him out of prison before before he dies in prison.
My final question for this week, it's kind of a little a stretch, but it relates to the Terrorism Suppression Act. Now, the Christchurch terrorist himself was charged under the Terrorism Suppression Act, but could that be applied to jihadists from New Zealand who went to overseas in Syria, like Mark Taylor?
Yeah, well, we know Mark Taylor, he's in a prison somewhere. There's a possibility he could get out and come back. In fact, there was, you know, a year or so ago, it was a very real possibility that the Syrians didn't want him, they would release him. But that hasn't happened so far. But if he were to make his way back to New Zealand, then we now have provisions under the Terrorism Suppression Act where he could be detained for a period of time once he crosses the border, an assessment made about what is in the community's best interest in terms of safety, what is in his best interest, and then work up a process from there. He could be detained for up to 2 years under the control order regime, and that can be renewed for a further period. So we do have measures to protect the community against somebody who is assessed as being unsafe. But unless and until someone like him comes back to the country, you know, it's hard to know, you know, what would happen and just how unsafe he is. He professes that he's abandoned his ideological views yet to be tested, but there is a process for keeping the community safe from people like him.
I know this isn't your portfolio and it has been scanty information recently, but does the New Zealand government have any updates on his position or situation?
No, look, as far as I know, he is still in Syria and in a jail. We were told that a year or so ago that the Syrian government wanted foreign nationals to go back to their countries of origin as quickly as possible and that they would try to make sure that happened. That hasn't happened. We can't, because we don't have any diplomatic presence in Syria, there's nothing that we can do. If he turns up to a New Zealand embassy somewhere, then we would have to engage with him, but he'd have to make his way back to New Zealand, and we're obliged to have him back in New Zealand because this is his country of citizenship. But we'd have measures to deal with him once he crossed the border.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.